Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. Pole position is back. Alina, can you explain?
So today we're going to be commemorating the death of Witold Pilecki, which occurred on the 25th of May 1948. And I'm honoured to work with Jack Fairweather, who is a former war reporter and an author who's written books like A War of Choice. But most recently he published a book on Witold Pilecki called The Volunteer, which has won the Costa Book Award. Welcome, Jack.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How was lockdown? How are you coping?
Well, as I'm sure you both know, lockdown has elements of the writer's life to it. So it's being locked away in a room is something I'm quite used to. However, that said, I was in the middle of doing a book tour, telling people about this remarkable man. So I'm sad not to be sharing his story as widely as I could.
Well, hopefully we're going to be able to solve a bit of that kind of problem, because we've got loads of questions for you and we're going to be talking about him. So let's start off with what inspired you to write a book about, I mean, this incredible, absolutely incredible man, Witold Pilecki, because he's barely known beyond the Polish community.
I totally, and my first reaction on hearing his story was, can this be true? How is it possible? And why have I not heard about this man before? It was about 10 years ago that I first came across his story. I met up with a war reporter friend of mine. We'd been covering the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we're both transitioning out of war zones. He had gone for a tour in Auschwitz as part of his journey and had heard about a resistance cell in the camp. And that was such a shock to me. I think for a lot of people outside Poland, when they think about Auschwitz, they know it by what it became, that terrible death factory for Europe's Jews. The idea that there was a sort of earlier camp, a concentration camp for Poles, is quite new. And I was shocked by the idea of resistance being possible in a place like Auschwitz. It was still the case that back then, 10 years ago, there was still no translation of Pilecki's sort of main report. And it was only a few years later, in 2012, that the 1945 report was translated, and I got to sort of identify who was the cell leader of the resistance in Auschwitz. And once I started finding out more about Witold Pilecki, I just knew I had to tell his story. That huge injustice as to why his story was not known more widely. Just the unbelievable tale of daring, courage, and intrigue, which is the story of his life. So that was what inspired me and got me going.
So let's start right at the beginning. So he was born on the 13th of May 1901 in what was the Russian Empire. Tell us more about his life before the Second World War.
So Witold Pilecki, before World War II, was a gentleman farmer in eastern Poland. He came from the sort of minor nobility in the area. He was a devout Catholic. He was a reserve officer in the Polish cavalry. He was married, had two little kids, and I think one of the elements that drew me to Pilecki's story and was that I but for World War II, he might have ended up his days as a small farmer, community activist, a man of faith and sort of deep social commitment, but not one of the great war heroes of World War II. And I think understanding what that transition was that he went through, what would push this man from a seemingly ordinary life into the extraordinary is really fascinating, because I think it offers something for us to connect with in his story. When we try and understand the man's motivations, it's you want to sort of connect with him in his earlier life.
So the Germans invade Poland on the 1st of September 1939. Where was he at this point?
He had been called up with his unit, and they had gone on boarded their troop transports and were riding to meet the German panzer divisions as they entered Poland. It was, you know, one of the facts of geography that he had to travel, you know, almost three times the distance to get to the point of contact than the Germans, who were crossing the border between the West Poland's western border. So he and his men, I mean, they were forced marching for several days. They were pretty exhausted and tired by the time they got into position. And, you know, they had to face the German Blitzkrieg, which, as we know, was devastatingly effective during the campaign. Pletsky and his men were caught in a rearguard action. His unit was devastated, and he then started sort of partisan guerrilla warfare for several weeks until it became clear that the situation was hopeless. A lot at that time, you know, the Polish military was disbanding, and many were thinking about how then to resist the German occupation, and Pletsky was right at the center of those thoughts. He traveled to Warsaw and began his resistance work, set up a cell with a colleague of his.
So Poland is now defeated and carved up between Germany and the Soviet Union. What does Pilecki do at this point?
So he is in Warsaw. He arranges to meet up with a group of fellow resistors. It's a remarkable scene. Warsaw was subject to an absolute devastating bombing campaign after Guernica. Was one of the, you know, first instances of a major city being indiscriminately bombed. A huge amount of the housing stocks devastated. There's no power and water, and Pletsky and his men have to sort of navigate curfew across Poland. There are thousands of Polish nationals being rounded up, some of them summarily executed. The figures are not precise, but it seems that, you know, up to 50,000 Polish nationals were shot in the first 4 months of the invasion. I mean, just an absolutely staggering number, which sort of gives a sense of this, you know, brutal, brutal occupation imposed by the Germans. And Pilecki and this small group decided in Warsaw to begin fighting back. He was not alone in this. There were multiple cells springing up across Warsaw, across the country, different sort of groups coming together. Many were were not very disciplined, or sort of understandably wishing to sort of fight back at once. As a result, there was a lot of reprisals, and Pletsky realized that he and his men would have to sort of hold back, gather their resources, and really sort of get to learn about what the Germans were up to. And that was also, as it turned out, the idea of the main underground leader in Warsaw at the time, the man who was to sort of, who brought together all of these groups, called Stefan Rowetzki. And he saw his task as really sort of gathering intelligence on the German occupation, both to begin to think about how to fight back against it, but also to share that information with allies in the West, with Britain and France. He wanted to sort of encourage them to take action to support Poland, and stories of brutality and the sort of shocking nature of the occupation would be really helpful in keeping Poland in their minds as they themselves struggled with the early stages of the war.
Let's fast forward to spring 1940, because we're going to start talking about Auschwitz, which is probably the most key point of this conversation. So it starts to function on the 14th of June 1940. Nobody knows what this place really truly is yet. Talk us through his decision, because he does. He decides to go into Auschwitz. I mean, this is an amazing decision to enter the concentration camp. How did he go about it, and why did he decide to do it?
Well, that's a great question. You know, my book is called The Volunteer, which sometimes gives us the impression that, you know, the underground leadership said, who wants to go to Auschwitz? And he sort of, Pilecki held up his hand enthusiastically. In actual fact, it was a really difficult decision for him. Auschwitz was sort of inaugurated in May 1940. The first prisoners arrived in, Polish prisoners arrived in June. It was designed to repress Poland, and little was really known about what was happening inside beyond a few rumors from a few released prisoners of particular brutality in the camp. And the underground leadership, Radetzky, decided that they needed to find out more about what was happening inside this camp. As part of this sort of intelligence gathering mission, and he turned to Pilecki as a man, you know, capable of pulling off this mission. Pilecki, by this stage, he'd been in this sort of early cell in Warsaw. Part of his job for the cell was as a recruiter. He had this really fantastic way with other people. He was a great judge of character. He was very inspiring when he spoke to young men and women to join the resistance, both in terms of getting them to sort of risk their lives in the name of Poland, but also to sort of ensure that they didn't sort of waste their lives in heedless acts of resistance. In fact, he was sort of nicknamed Nanny of his group. And of course, those are qualities that would be really useful for any fact-finding mission to Auschwitz. But of course, how do you get into Auschwitz? You couldn't just sort of walk up to the front gates. Pilecki hit upon this idea of positioning himself in a part of Warsaw that was going to be subject to a German roundup. Pilecki's group had contacts in the elements of the Polish police force that had been retained by the Germans, and who could give tip-offs about these big roundups, which basically were, as they sound, the Germans would seal off an area of the city and just sort of start dragging military age men off the streets to incarcerate them, to send them to forced labor or to concentration camps. And so Pilecki got this tip-off. There was going to be one in August, and just to give you a sense of how difficult this decision was for him, he'd just been reunited with his wife and kids, who had fled their home in eastern Poland to come to central Poland to Pilecki's parents-in-law. He would be, as underground member on this mission, would be exposing them to huge danger. He was going to be leaving behind his network of men that he built up and to whom he was such a sort of important figure. And that first roundup came and went, because he decided he couldn't make up his mind whether or not to do it. And it was only the following month, in September, that he sort of summoned the nerve to place himself in an apartment in an area he knew was going to be raided by the Germans. And so that takes us to just this extraordinary moment in the story, where he is sitting in this apartment building. It's his sister-in-law's flat. He's sitting there listening to the German trucks pull up outside, and then he hears the Germans breaking into the building, ordering out men to gather outside, and the door bursts open, and there they are for him, and he steps into captivity. And you know, this was a scene I really wanted to tell in depth in the book, and it was just a real joy and honor to discover that there was a witness to this scene. It was that the flat he was sitting in was his sister-in-law's, and his nephew, a man called Marek Ostrowski, had been 3 years old at the time of the roundup. He was still alive, is still alive, I got to meet him and take him back to that apartment, because incredibly that apartment still stands. It wasn't destroyed in the Warsaw Uprising, and we walked around the different rooms, and he told me, he sort of recounted his mother's memories of that morning, but then he had his own really special memory that I think only he could have had, and that was just at that moment that the Germans are bursting in. Paletsky's got his jacket on. Marek's mum was at the door letting them in. Marek remembered how Paletsky reached down and picked up his teddy bear that had fallen on the floor and handed it to him. And that, for me, just spoke so much of what Paletsky was about, that in that moment of maximum drama and tension, where you think he would only be thinking about himself, he was able to spot the little three-year-old boy looking scared on his bed and hand him his teddy bear to console him.
That's incredible. What does the camp look like when he gets there?
So it's quite, so for listeners who have been to the camp, it's quite different. It was quite different in its first inception. There were a lot less buildings. For one thing, it had been used as a horse barracks. So some of the buildings, you know, were there two-story. Several of the buildings were single-story. There wasn't the double line of barbed wire fencing or the electric fencing that came later. The roll call square in the center of the camp was much, much bigger, had not been built over. You know, Paletsky arrived at night, and he describes, I think, in some of his most exceptional writing, that just the absolute shocking brutality of his arrival. Of course, he, unlike everyone, all the other prisoners who were seized on that morning, he had an idea of what was in store. But even then, he found it just off the charts, as he and the other prisoners were dragged from the trains, beaten. 10 men were summarily executed right in front of him, and then they're sort of driven into the camp through the gates. Though that Arbat Makhpry gate was there at that time, and then they're stripped and shaved. Jewish prisoners are identified by their circumcisions and set upon with a special fury. Although at this stage it is still a camp, it is the camp for Polish nationals, and there was no greater plan to exterminate the country's Jews at that point. And you know, he describes it like stepping into another world, like stepping into hell. And his first few days in the camp are, you know, he's walking around dazed, struggling, like so many prisoners arriving in Auschwitz, to accept that level of violence and brutality was possible.
His purpose in Auschwitz, you've mentioned, was to gather intelligence and start a resistance movement. How did he go about doing this?
So So I think his first thing that he had to do was just survive, and it took him a week or so to really find his bearings. Prisoners were sent to do like murderous labor details around the camp. They were on starvation rations of often less than 1,000 calories a day, and subject to sort of continual hazing by the German prisoners known as capos, who were the functionaries who controlled the camp for the SS. Paletsky, with a stroke of good luck and a bit of initiative, was able to land a job working indoors briefly. And, that allowed him to begin to take stock. And that was the point where he began reaching out to the other prisoners. Now, Paletsky doesn't describe his, that moment of connecting with other prisoners, but I was able to track down a testimony in which one of his early recruits describes the incredible moment when Paletsky taps him on the shoulder and leads him to one side. Prisoners were allowed to gather just before the evening lockdown outside their barracks, and they would often meet in a big huddle to exchange food or gossips, and the German capos would be patrolling. It was, a time of brief respite. It was still a time of fear because the Germans planted informers or paid informers with bread and food and special treats to grass up each other. So you had to be really careful. Paletsky took aside this young man and said, "Do you want to join the underground?" And the young man, the reason I particularly like this anecdote, looked at Paletsky and said, to paraphrase, "Are you nuts? Look at us. We are in, how can we resist the Germans in a place like this?" In some ways, it's that same reaction that I had upon learning the story. And how is it possible to do it? And then this recruit begins to realize something. One, that Paletsky's for real. He really is planning to build up an underground in the camp. But then he realizes that, Paletsky has entrusted him with this secret that he could, if he wanted to, use against Paletsky. He could shop him to one of those capos patrolling the square for some bread or a safer job indoors. But he didn't, because he realized that Paletsky had trusted him, and that trust showed that something greater than themselves could endure in the camp. And so he said yes to Paletsky, and the two men hugged, and that was in some ways the start of the underground. Paletsky was to do this dozens and dozens of times in the camp, and each time exposing himself to a huge amount of danger, because anyone he spoke to about the underground could try and use that knowledge to save their lives. And I think it's one of the most extraordinary facts about Paletsky's underground that for the hundreds of men that he gathered together to resist the Nazis in Auschwitz, not one of them ever betrayed him. And I think that really speaks to both Paletsky as a leader, as a man, an inspirer of confidence, but also just of that need for trust, for hope that he was able to offer so many prisoners in Auschwitz.
He nearly dies, doesn't he?
He does nearly die. That first autumn, when he has that brief moment of working indoors, he gets a job as a stove fitter briefly, and then he finds a another detail that's demolishing a house nearby where he can sort of harbor his strength. But then he's placed in this brutal work detail, and you know, he describes returning to the camp. He's sort of working in a warehouse unloading supplies, where they have to sort of run with 100-pound bags of cement, and it's just lift girders and just general building supplies. And he just describes walking back to the camp, and he knows if he falls down, he will be set upon by the capos and finished off. And he describes coming in and out of consciousness, just say, you know, just willing himself to get back to the camp in order to sort of fall asleep and then rise and do it all over again the next day. And, you know, I found that really, you know, really affecting, reading his account and the account of so many prisoners who were brought to the very edge of human endurance by what was happening in the camp.
So let's talk us through the decision and the actual escape itself.
We were able to track down that first report. It turned out that it made its way all the way to London, and it was just sitting in the archives of the Polish Underground Study Trust, and which is this amazing archive of Polish Underground material that was saved after the war. We'll perhaps come on to that story, but suffice to say that I got a call from my researcher in London one evening to say, "Jack, I've found Paletsky's report." And I think one of the reasons why it was such a powerful moment for us was that Paletsky couldn't write anything down in the camp, so he had had his first messenger memorize it. This word-for-word report, this oral report. And so the words that we discovered in this archive in London were pretty much Paletsky's own words. And this is what he had to say: "Please, for the love of God, bomb Auschwitz, even if it means killing everyone in the camp, because what's happening here is so terrible, it has to end." And this was just really stunning to me. You know, Paletsky was calling for the bombing of Auschwitz years before it became part of a public debate among Allied commanders. And we were able to then find out what happened to that report, how it was passed on by the Polish government in exile to the RAF command, and they debated fairly seriously whether or not they should bomb Auschwitz. And, you know, surely one of history's great mice and beans had, you know, what would have happened had Paletsky's report been acted upon at that moment. And what happened then over the next 2.5 years of Paletsky's incarceration was that he continued to get out messages to the Allies. Pretty much every message carried a request for the Allies to take action. Sometimes it would involve, he asked them to sort of airdrop weapons in or drop in a parachute air brigade of commandos. He was just trying different ideas to see what might be possible. And one of the reasons why his story is so historically important is that each one of these reports described a new step on the road towards the death factory that Auschwitz was to become. Paletsky described the brutal treatment of Polish prisoners, then the attempts to euthanize sick prisoners. He described the arrival of Soviet POWs and the first experiments in gassing those prisoners. And then, of course, he describes the Holocaust itself. And, you know, Paletsky, I think, helps us see how the Nazi leadership was able to conceive of and implement mass murder on an industrial scale. And you know, his reports, you know, just, you know, are heartbreaking for that reason. If any one of them had registered with those who read them in London, we might be talking about a very different history of Auschwitz. But for reasons I go into in the book, you know, his reports didn't spur action. And so Paletsky, you know, he discovers this after about 2 years in the camp. A prisoner arrives who comes from the underground leadership itself in Warsaw, and Paletsky tracks him down and says, you know, what's happened to my reports? You know, when are we going to take action? And the man says, oh, you know, we've got all your reports, but you know, we're not focused on Auschwitz at all. We've got other issues to deal with. And, you know, Paletsky, you know, it's like a sucker punch to him. You know, he picks himself up from that shock and resolves to escape himself despite the great dangers, in the hope that he can rally a force to attack the camp. Just a sort of classic Paletsky moment where, you know, in that maximum moment of sort of fear and doubt, he finds the strength to turn that into action, to something positive. So he begins to plan his own escape. You know, that became a real centerpiece of the book. Paletsky describes it in lovely detail and brilliantly. One of his fellow escapers, he escaped with two other prisoners, also left a memoir. So it was something I could really write about in great detail by cross-referencing their two accounts, and then also sort of recreating the escape myself for the research. My research Marta and I, we found the spot where he escaped from the camp. It was a civilian bakery that was staffed by prisoners. Paletsky arranged for him and the other men to switch units to the bakery. From there, we tried our best to follow in his footsteps. We left at the same time as he had done, early hours of the morning in late April, and then used the clues he gives us in the text to recreate his footsteps. And, I think, we would then show up in little villages and towns and try and track down older residents to ask them about what the place was like during the wartime. And it happened on a few occasions that we would meet families that had actually sheltered Paletsky and the escapers. Just the most, you know, just incredible to be able to find, you know, that oral history, you know, that living history right before us. The house where the safe house he finally reached at the end of his escape, the owner of that house had been a child when Paletsky and his men arrived there. And, you know, she showed us around the house. She made us tea and sandwiches, and we sat at the table where Paletsky and his fellow escapers sat. And I think as a biographer, you're always chasing after the subject of your dreams, as it were. And that was one of those moments where I actually felt like I'd finally caught up with Paletsky. At that table, he was to write his first history of the resistance in Auschwitz, his first attempt to get his head around what had happened in Auschwitz. And it was incredibly powerful to sit at that same table with someone who remembered him sitting there and share in the moment.
His escape was successful. He returned to Warsaw on the 23rd of August 1943. What does he do when he gets there?
So his escape was successful, and I think it really is insight into his thinking that, you know, no sooner had he found a safe place to hide out whilst the SS are sort of conducting a search for him, then he's already trying to arrange for a force to attack Auschwitz. He goes to the leadership in Krakow. They don't believe his story. Not the first time that this was to happen. They fear that he might be a German agent provocateur who is, they can't understand how any prisoner can escape from Auschwitz. He, frustrated, he then goes to Warsaw and, you know, then begins to see what is happening, you know, across the war. And this is in autumn of 1943, and the war has already decisively turned against the Germans at this point. In the Eastern Front, the Russians have broken through, and it appears that a Soviet occupation of Poland may be looming, which of course spells disaster for Poland. There's a lot of debate about how to prepare for the Soviet occupation, when or whether to rise up against the Germans before the Russians arrive. And, you know, what's happening in Auschwitz is just not, you know, it's not the primary focus of the underground. They are thinking about the struggle for national survival at that stage. And, you know, Paletsky, he writes another report, this time, you know, in much greater detail, and then, you know, is forced to accept the reality of the situation, which is that they've got to expend all of their energy throwing off the shackles of the German occupation and trying to stake a claim for independence before the Russians come. And that's the backdrop then for the events of the Warsaw Uprising.
So he does participate in the Warsaw Uprising, doesn't he, on the 1st of August 1944?
He does. He's actually had already agreed to join a underground cell that was going to potentially resist the Russians in the event of the Soviet occupation, and had been ordered to sort of hold back and, you know, prepare for whatever came next. But of course, Paletsky, you know, wasn't going to do that. He and one of his fellow escapers end up in a unit that's right in the sort of thick of the fighting in the heart of Warsaw. And he lives through that cataclysmic battle, which sees, you know, vast swathes of the city destroyed, tens and tens of thousands of people killed in the fighting, and ultimately defeat at the hands of the Germans. You know, there's, you know, this particularly tragic element to the story, in that tragic element to the Warsaw Uprising, in that the Soviets had reached the outskirts of the city. And of course, that was the whole point of the uprising, that just as the Russians arrived, the Polish underground wanted to sort of take part in driving out the Germans, and thereby, through that act of independence, state their right to exist. But the Soviets arrived, but then they didn't proceed to help in any way at all. So the underground was ultimately crushed. Paletsky is captured, surrenders with the rest, and goes into captivity again. And he sees out most of the rest of the war in German concentration camps, and is finally liberated by the US military in a camp outside in Bavaria, in Murnau, and is then faced by that choice facing every Pole at that time. Country Poland is occupied by the Soviet forces, and yet Nazi Germany is defeated. Does he go back to fight against the Soviets? And of course, that is his ultimate resolution, and that sets the stage for the final sort of tragic episode of his life.
So he fights with undead in Italy, and he decides after the war to return back to Poland, and he knows exactly what's waiting for him there. Let's talk about that fateful day where he actually gets arrested. Talk us through what happened.
He's created an underground cell in Warsaw, this time to spy on and report on the atrocities of the Soviet occupation, and pretty much the same thing that he was doing against the Germans. Whilst we were celebrating VE Day and the end of the war, Eastern Europe, Central Europe, Poland in particular, was subject to a brutal repression that in many ways was as devastating as anything that happened during the war. Tens of thousands of underground members like Paletsky were being rounded up for incarceration. Hundreds were being executed summarily. It was a time of massive unrest, lawlessness, hunger, and of course, brutal Soviet-backed repression in the name of communism. And Paletsky, his cell is operating, trying to raise awareness in the West as to what is happening. And his group is infiltrated by a sort of communist informer, and it leads to his arrest. He heads back to an apartment, a safe apartment, one evening, and he's picked up by two plainclothes men and led to the head of the Polish secret police's headquarters in Warsaw, and then subjected to months of brutal interrogation and torture, and then finally a show trial, and in which he is given a death sentence for crimes against the communist regime. And it's a really brutal end to his story, but even amazingly, in that setting, in that trial, one of his reported things that he said to the courtroom when he was asked if he had anything to say was that he had lived his life he'd lived his life hoping to he'd lived his life so that he would be happy when it would, in the moment of its ending. In other words, he'd lived his life with courage and conviction and would not do anything differently. And so ends his life. But then, of course, the story of what happened to his legacy begins, because it's at this point that communist authorities try and repress his story, succeed in repressing his story. And so begins the struggle by some brilliant Polish historians, by his family, to reclaim their father, Paletsky's legacy.
Jack, I want to say thank you so much for coming on board with us and talking to us about this incredibly remarkable man, Witold Pilecki, who went through one stage of hell, the Warsaw Uprising, fighting in Italy, to then come back to communist Poland to go back into hell a second time, and unfortunately not surviving any of it. So thank you so much.
Thank you, my pleasure.
Join us a bit later on when we will be talking to Gilad Jaffe. We promised he'd come back to talk to you about the archaeology of Jerusalem, and he has. It's great. Down the pub, we will be discussing the most important moment in history. A moment is being defined as something less than a week, so it can't be a long event. We've got some great choices coming up on that, actually. And then tomorrow, we will be talking to Gary Powers Jr., all about his father's experiences as a spy plane pilot and of being shot down over the Soviet Union. That's a really fascinating talk. You can now nominate History Hack for an award. If you go to britishpodcastawards.com, you can nominate us for a Listener's Choice Award. You have to do your vote by the 6th of July 2020, and they will announce the winner at the British Podcast Awards on Saturday, the 11th of July 2020. So if you wouldn't mind, we'd really appreciate it. There now follows a public service announcement.
I'm Horatio Hornblower. And I'm Archie Kennedy. The simplest gift you can give in these troubled times is to obey orders.
Indeed. The regulations are very clear in the matter. It is the duty of all of us to remain at anchor until the little people in the talking box signal you otherwise.
You don't want to end up getting flogged.
Good day to you.
Good day to you both.